From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. People across the country today are marking the first anniversary of George Floyd's murder. In Minneapolis, they're gathering in George Floyd Square, the intersection where Floyd died after former police officer Derek Chauvin placed his knee on Floyd's neck. Last month, Chauvin was found guilty of murder by a jury. Over the weekend, Floyd's sister Bridget spoke at a rally alongside the Reverend Al Sharpton.
It has been a long year. It has been a painful year. It has been very frustrating for me and my family. For your life to change within a blink of an eye, I still don't know why.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter John Collins is in Minneapolis. John, first, what's the feeling there? How are residents feeling? What's the sense on the street? What's going on?
Sure. You know, right now it's really a kind of a feeling of celebration. You know, people are still coming off of the conviction of Derek Chauvin on three serious charges. But there is still a lot going on that's led to some uncertainty because we have Chauvin's sentencing coming up next month. The trial on federal civil rights charges against all four officers that were involved in July, and then next spring, the other three cops charged in Floyd's killing are going to go on trial in state court. So there's still a lot in the air, and of course, it's not only celebration, it's sadness and a sense of loss for Floyd's life.
Yeah. Well, and yesterday you attended a panel of family members whose loved ones have also been killed by police. It included the mothers of Oscar Grant, who was killed by a BART officer in the Bay Area, an officer who says he mistook his gun for a taser. Eric Garner, who died in a police chokehold during an attempt to arrest him in New York for selling single cigarettes. What were they calling for?
So legally, these families, they're calling for laws that reform policing and that make it easier to jail cops who kill someone. And a bill named in George Floyd's honor did pass the U.S. House, although the U.S. Senate hasn't yet voted on that. But even more than just those legal things, they're urging people not to take their foot off the pedal, that a conviction of Derek Chauvin is not enough, they say, when 1,000 people a year are killed by American police. And so they're telling the public it's not just about the big names that people know, George Floyd, Oscar Grant, but about those other 1,000 people and their lives and their families too.
And a need for more support for families impacted by police violence?
That's right. I mean, Katie Wright, she's the mother of Dante Wright, who a young black man who was shot and killed just last month during Chauvin's trial by a police officer in a suburb of the Twin Cities. And she told the crowd that activists and the community do need to get better about supporting grieving families. And sometimes she said it seems like people have their own motive or they want some social media clout or even they want to raise money off their loved ones. And she said that in her case, not once has someone just asked her, hey, what can I do for you?
Yeah. Well, these family members also said that changing the law to curb police violence isn't easy. And we know that that's true in Minneapolis as well, that there was a move by some city council members to replace the police with a public safety agency. That's being debated. But even some black leaders have said, no, we need the police. So where does police reform in Minneapolis stand in the minute we have?
I mean, it's up in the air. In Minneapolis, the mayor has announced some policy changes to the police because he's in control of it. But there is, as you mentioned, a larger effort to change the city's charter, to get rid of the MPD and create a new Department of Public Safety. And voters are going to consider that question on their ballot in November. Mm-hmm. So it still is playing out in Minneapolis.
Yeah, we'll follow you following that story. Minnesota Public Radio reporter John Collins in Minneapolis on this, the first anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. John, thank you.
Thank you.
COVID-19 cases are surging in Haiti, so much so the government has declared an 8-day health emergency and is instituting a nightly curfew. This news underscores the dire situation there, which is also dealing with a deepening political crisis and a wave of kidnappings. This week, the Biden administration offered at least temporary relief from deportation to some Haitian immigrants living here in the U.S. Immigrant groups welcome the move, but are now calling for a longer-term solution to follow. Jacqueline Charles is a reporter for the Miami Herald, and she joins us now on Skype. And Jacqueline, first tell us about this immigration action by the president. What does it do?
Well, what it does is it provides a safe haven for a minimum of 100,000 Haitians who are currently living in the United States. Some of them are already enrolled in the temporary protected status programs. Others do not have this status, so they basically have been undocumented. And what the administration is saying, that anyone who qualifies and who has been in the United States as of the 21st of May can apply once the application process opens. So for a lot of people who've been living with the anxiety, the fear of being deported, being sent back to Haiti, this really is good news for this community. And it wasn't just a renewal or an extension, but it was a new designation, which means that it opens the pool up so that new immigrants can apply.
Well, you've been speaking with immigrants and advocacy groups who've been calling for this for years. As you said, this is a temporary extension of immigration status. But is there any progress toward a permanent immigration solution for Haitian immigrants who came after the devastating earthquake in 2010?
Exactly. And that is what the advocacy community is saying now, you know, that they are very grateful to the Biden administration for doing this. But while they are celebrating, they want to remember that really what is needed is a permanent pathway to citizenship. The Biden administration did put forth a bill in Congress to try and get that. And so that is really where the next fight, the next battleground is going to be, to get permanent pathway to citizenship for undocumented migrants in this country. And I think I've heard numbers like 11 million.
Well, let's talk about why that's so important. The situation in Haiti, some folks are saying, is dire. Haiti is in the grips of a new surge in coronavirus cases, and it's also in the grips of a political crisis. Can you give us a sense of conditions there?
I mean, you have today a deepening political crisis. You have a constitutional crisis where you have some people who are saying that the president's mandate actually expired February 7th of this year. He is saying no. The Biden administration has backed him up on that. At the same time, you have an alarming spike in kidnappings that have occurred in this country. I mean, where people are asking for $1 million, $5 million ransom, U.S. dollars, in a country where the average person lives on less than $2 a day. The economy has just collapsed. And now you have to surge. I mean, Haiti is the one country that everybody was looking at in this hemisphere, wondering about how would it cope with COVID, given the weakness of its healthcare system. You know, for the last year, Haitians haven't really believed in the COVID pandemic. There's no vaccine. It is the only country in Latin America and the Caribbean that has yet to administer a shot of any COVID vaccine.
Let's slow down here, Jacqueline. That's remarkable. There have been no vaccination efforts on the island?
There's no vaccination efforts right now. What has happened is that the country is among 10 countries that qualifies for free vaccines as part of the UN-backed COVAX program. They were supposed to receive 756,000 doses as part of an initial deployment. But because they were very slow in approving, they have finally now agreed to accept AstraZeneca vaccine. But as a result of what's happening in India, where their vaccines were supposed to come from, there's now a wait. So they may not see a vaccine maybe by July or maybe August. And that first shipment is just going to be 132,000 doses in a population of 11.5 million.
Has the Biden administration announced or said they would announce any new policies aimed at helping Haiti beyond this TPS extension we mentioned? You laying out the crisis there, including the coronavirus crisis, it really seems like the country needs more help.
Exactly. For Haitians in Haiti, you know, the TPS issue is just only part of their expectation from this administration. But what they really want is for the United States to step into the fray, to reassess its policy on Haiti, and to really address what's happening on the ground. They want the United States to take sort of a harder stance on the the administration of President Jovenel Moïse, who has been ruling by decree for more than a year, which means that he has no parliament. He is one of only 11 elected officials in this country of 11.5 million people. The U.S. has equated democracy in Haiti to the holding of elections, but has not said anything about good governance. At the same time, the U.S. has a level 4 travel warning telling Americans, you cannot go to this country because of the kidnappings, because it's unsafe, and now because of COVID. People are being kidnapped, you know, anywhere across the capital where nobody is safe. And I mean, from school kids to teachers to professionals, even for journalists, there have been a number of cases where journalists have been assaulted, they've been attacked during protests. And when the president was asked about this not long ago at a UN Security Council meeting, he basically said, oh, no, these were not journalists who were attacked. These were gang members who were dressed as journalists. So there's a lot of concerns about this country. And today, Haiti is a mess. It's chaotic. And Haitians are asking for the U.S., which has always been heavily involved in its affairs, to basically take a step back and just come back with a different policy.
That's Jacqueline Charles, reporter for the Miami Herald. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, China and the Philippines held what the capital Manila called candid, friendly talks on the South China Sea. But tensions have erupted in recent weeks as Chinese fishing boats were spotted congregating in Philippine-controlled waters. Previously, Manila tolerated China's presence, but it now says it looks more like an encroachment. NPR's Julie McCarthy takes a look at this complicated story.
Where the Chinese see ordinary traffic, Filipinos see incursions. One day this month, the Philippines counted 287 Chinese trawlers across its exclusive economic zone, a boundary reaching 200 nautical miles from its coast. Weeks earlier, hundreds of Chinese boats anchored in the Philippine-claimed Spratly Islands at Whitsun Reef. Beijing says a few hundred boats massing out of its fleet of thousands is not unusual. But such swarms raise fears that China is not only overfishing, but overreaching, with possible hostile intent. The Philippines' top diplomat, Teddy Loxing Jr., told NPR he now routinely orders Beijing to move its boats out.
For example, in Whitsun Reef, 220 to 240 vessels show up. I get mad, I file a diplomatic protest. And the Chinese say, no, they're just fishing. But all they're doing is annoying us, raising suspicion throughout Southeast Asia. So I told them, you must have fished a lot by now. Do you mind leaving? And they started to leave. But then they're coming back again.
The latest incident reminds Filipinos of earlier episodes when Beijing took control of features in Philippine waters. Scarborough Shoal in 2012. Earlier at Mischief Reef in 1995. There, Singapore-based analyst Colin Koh says the takeover began with a few vessels loitering around the reef.
And right after that, you know, we saw the construction of wooden structures. And then it got graduated into concrete structures. And what we have right now is a full artificial island replete with airstrip. And now the stationing of, you know, warships in the area. So this is likely the scenario we might be looking at.
Competing claims to the South China Sea have simmered for decades. Disputes among the six claimant countries, including the Philippines and Vietnam, have settled into an uneasy standoff. But China's aggression in recent months coincides with Beijing's crushing of democracy in Hong Kong and its scorning of international protests over its crackdown. Seen through that lens, China's teeming presence in Philippine waters is unnerving. Manila-based defense analyst Jose Custodio.
The Chinese basically are sending a strong signal to the countries in the region that we own this area. And this is China's way of testing the resolve of the Biden administration, barely been in office for half a year.
Regional observers say China's ambition in the South China Sea is part of a broader struggle to displace the United States as the dominant power in the Pacific. This past week, China said a U.S. vessel had illegally entered waters near the Paracel Islands. Custodio says the U.S. has shown up in force for what it claims are efforts to protect freedom of navigation of the sea and eye Chinese maneuvers.
The presence is very formidable. It's something that the Chinese cannot challenge. It's a carrier task group, the Roosevelt, if I'm correct, and then the America, which is an amphibious assault ship, together with its complement of support ships, backed up by contingents coming from Japan.
The American presence did likely embolden the Philippine Armed Forces to more vigorously patrol the South China Sea, a show of defiance toward Beijing that has been missing since President Duterte took office extolling China over the United States. Duterte has cultivated collegial non-confrontation with China, even as it militarized islands. But Duterte is now under pressure to change tack. And in remarks directed at Beijing, Duterte said that Philippine patrols would continue.
I am not ready to withdraw. Ngayon, hindi talaga ako atras. Patayin mo man ako kung patayin.
I'm not going to retreat. Kill me if you want to kill me, but I'll stay put, Duterte said, adding with little apparent conviction, this is where our friendship ends. Duterte's vow to defend Philippine sovereignty comes at a time of sky-high public distrust of China, and as the Philippines heads into the 2022 national elections. Candidates running to succeed Duterte are expected to campaign against his refusal to condemn China's ever bolder claim to nearly all of the South China Sea. Manila-based analyst Robert Herrera Lim says the growing hawkish tone of the U.S.-backed Philippine military may signal that Duterte's pro-Beijing policy has reached its peak.
And we are moving into a phase where the military starts probing and the Navy start probing to say, how can they show that they are asserting Philippine rights in those disputed waters? So showing up is half the battle.
The Biden administration, shaped by longtime Asia specialists, is leading an international effort against China. It's also rejuvenating its alliance with the Philippines, an outreach that Jose Custodio says is easily summed up.
If you need us, if you're intimidated by the Chinese, call us and we'll be there. We'll back you up.
But he says once things quiet down, the Chinese will be back, and the Philippines must step up with its own assets. He says it cannot simply rely on the Americans. Foreign Secretary Teddy Loxin says being in the middle of two colossal powers requires a delicate balance, but he's in no doubt about who he's aligning with.
I'm not going to take a chance. This I know. Historically, America, at the height of its power, never wanted to take any other country. They just want to be number one. That's fine with me. That's okay. I can live with that.
As for number two, Loxin says, I can be friends with China, but I cannot let them in the door. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
If you're an early riser, you may be in for a treat tomorrow morning. The super flower blood moon will be visible early Wednesday in some parts of the country, turning the full moon a deep rusty red. Kelly Beatty joins us now with more. He's senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Hi, Kelly.
Hello, Tonya.
Thank you for being here. So where will the total lunar eclipse be visible and at what time?
So it's basically an eclipse for the Pacific Ocean, Australia, Eastern Asia, and the west coast of North America. On the east coast, we're not going to see it. Everywhere west of the Rockies should be able to see totality just before sunrise. On the west coast in Pacific time zone, the eclipse, although it lasts a couple of hours, will peak at about 4:19 a.m.
Oh, I'll get to see it then. That's great. Where will people be able to see a partial eclipse?
That's from a wider area, say from, you know, the Midwest to the west of that. Right at dawn, the moon will be setting, the sun will be rising, and if you get up in time to see the setting moon before sunrise, you'll see a big bite out of it, which is the last bit of the partial phase of this eclipse.
Okay, let's get into what some people will see and why they will see it. And let's first talk about the name. How did this name come about, especially the flower and the blood part of it?
Okay, so there are Native American folklore names associated with each full moon of the year. And the flower moon, which comes in May, is sort of self-evident because flowers are in bloom all over the place. This is also a full moon that will be particularly close to the Earth, the closest one all year. And so that's sometimes called a supermoon. And then the last part of this name, the blood moon, comes from the fact that during the total eclipse, although you would think that the moon would be completely black, there's actually a little bit of light leaking around the Earth through its atmosphere, and that light gets colored red, shines weakly on the surface of the moon, and we see that as a dim red or coppery color.
This overall is eclipse season. There's also a solar eclipse on June 10th. Is it common for a solar eclipse to follow a lunar eclipse?
It is, actually. They can come in pairs, 2 weeks apart. So lunar eclipses occur at full moon. 2 weeks later, the moon has swung halfway around its orbit and its new moon, and that's when solar eclipses occur. So on June 10th, the moon will pass between the Earth and the sun, and sometimes that creates a total solar eclipse, like we saw back in 2017 here in the United States. But because the moon will be a little bit farther than average at that point, it will cross directly in front of the sun and not quite cover it all. It will leave literally a ring of sunlight in the sky. Now, that won't be visible from everywhere. The track is actually quite remote: Canada, Greenland, Siberia. On the east coast of the U.S., especially the northeast, people should get up at sunrise to watch this partial solar eclipse emerging above the horizon. Anyone on the west coast, I'm afraid, is going to miss out.
Oh, well, good. We'll get to see the total lunar eclipse tomorrow, and the east coast will have something to look forward to on June 10th. What else should people keep an eye out for in the night sky this week?
Well, this week in particular, because the full moon is in the sky, it's going to be fairly bright, and so a lot of the stars will be not as evident as they otherwise would. But if you wait right after sunset and look low in the west, you'll see a brilliant star very close to the horizon. That's actually the planet Venus, and it's emerging into the evening sky for the first time in many months, and it will be with us all summer long.
Oh, a lot to look forward to. Kelly Beatty is senior editor of Sky and Telescope. Thank you so much.
A pleasure, Tonya.
I'm Yowei Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
And it's official. There's going to be a face-to-face meeting between President Biden and Russia's President Putin next month in Geneva on June 16th. Oh, to be a fly on that wall. So many tensions between the two over election interference and cyber attacks, among other things. NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow is here with more on today's announcement. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
The same to you. And lots of tension. So what's likely to be on the table June 16th?
Seems like a lot of things are on the table, according to people who have been in these conversations, everything from nuclear arms control to Iran and North Korea to Syria to climate change. Biden has made it clear that he is going to continue confronting, raising concerns with Putin over the way that Russia has been pressuring Ukraine, what's been going on this week with Belarus, you know, forcing planes out of the sky to arrest dissidents, you know, with conversations about whether Russia was aware of that or supported that effort. A lot of things talking about, but the Biden White House has kind of also indicated that we should not expect any sort of grand agreement or announcement to come out of this. This is more about establishing a one-on-one relationship and having conversations going to try and resolve some of these areas where there are resolution points.
Such a long list. And this meeting will come after Biden meets with G7 leaders and later NATO allies in Europe. What do you make of that timing coming at the end of Biden's first overseas trip as president?
Yeah, I think there is some clear thinking here that Biden wants to be able to consult with allies, especially NATO allies, before he sits down with Putin. Biden, for so long, you know, throughout his entire career as a senator, as a vice president, has really dwelled and focused on one-on-one relationships with world leaders, feeling like if he can get to know somebody, they can solve a lot of problems. And He, of course, has not been able to do that so far in his presidency, with just a couple of exceptions of meetings at the White House with the leaders of Japan and South Korea. So I think Biden is clearly very excited to be able to go and meet his counterparts face to face in Europe. And, you know, there are a lot of different things to deal with on this trip, with the G7, which, of course, used to be the G8 before Russia was booted out of it, and NATO leading into this one-on-one with Putin in Geneva, which is also clearly a very symbolic meeting point for a summit.
Yeah. And the last standalone U.S.-Russia summit was in Helsinki, 2018. Then President Trump drew a lot of criticism for publicly siding with Putin over Trump's own intelligence agencies when Putin denied meddling in the 2016 election. And former President Trump also met Putin on the sidelines of the G20 in Japan, 2019, and appeared to make light of Russian election interference. What's your sense of President Biden and how he'll approach Putin?
So there's two phrases that you keep hearing from the Biden White House when they talk about how they view Russia. The first is clear-eyed. Obviously, President Biden has been more skeptical and more confrontational with Russia, you know, not disputing that Russia interfered in U.S. elections, not questioning whether Russia was behind that massive solar winds hack. Those are two things that led to increased sanctions that Biden announced about a month or so ago. The other thing that the White House keeps saying is they want stability and predictability. I thought it was notable that Biden called Putin ahead of time and said, look, these sanctions are coming. And that's when he said, I would also like to meet with you one on one. They're trying to not pretend that they're going to be friends, but want to be able to have a dialogue going and channels going, which has just really broken down over the past few years between the U.S. and Russia.
It's NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow on today's announcement that President Biden will meet with Russian President Putin next month in Geneva, June 16th. Mark your calendar. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
CNN's Chris Cuomo is still on the job, despite calls that he take a leave of absence after last week's admission that he advised his brother, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, on how to speak about an ongoing sexual harassment scandal. On his show, the younger Cuomo, Chris, said it wouldn't happen again.
It was a mistake, because I put my colleagues here, who I believe are the best in the business, in a bad spot. I never intended for that. I would never intend for that. And I am sorry for that.
And CNN decided against disciplining him, but they dismissed conservative commentator Rick Santorum for telling an audience that we, meaning European settlers, birthed a nation from nothing. There was nothing here, dismissing early Native Americans. Well, this is all giving NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik lots to think about. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
And we've spoken before about Chris Cuomo's on-air relationship with his brother in their informal interviews when Chris Cuomo was fighting COVID-19 literally and his brother Andrew, the governor, fighting it as governor. That arched a lot of brows. Then Governor Cuomo, beset by these allegations of real misconduct. Remind us what Chris Cuomo did after that.
Well, Chris Cuomo said that he acknowledged the elephant in the room, so to speak, and said he wouldn't be covering the question of sexual harassment allegations raised now by multiple women, in certain cases perhaps misconduct, in others what seems more like more physical contact. He said that his colleagues would be doing that, but that he couldn't possibly do so in an objective way about his older brother. That's fine insofar as it goes, but, you know, it kind of takes off the table the fact that a year ago, Chris Cuomo was, you know, effectively having a fraternal food fight with his brother for entertainment purposes in a primetime hour of CNN, elevating kind of the humanity and highlighting what was at the time viewed as the, you know, great role that Andrew Cuomo had played in handling COVID. Those the question of that very handling of COVID has now come under journalistic scrutiny and been cast in a much more negative light.
Yeah, people are wondering maybe there should be sharper questions of Andrew Cuomo at that time. But now there are reports that Chris Cuomo, in these conversations with the governor and his staff, encouraged his brother to not resign, take a defiant stand. Why didn't CNN discipline Chris Cuomo now?
I think it's very much a question of the real estate he occupies and the stature he has for the network. As you say, Chris Cuomo took part in essentially damage control strategy planning, not just with his older brother, which maybe you could understand, but with his older brother's staffers present as well. And that puts him inserts him in kind of an official mode, a line a journalist shouldn't cross. You're not supposed to be too close with the people you cover. Well, he couldn't be closer. And to be actively planning is essentially trying to do damage control from his colleagues and others, their peers at other networks. In this instance, CNN said, you know, he shouldn't be talking to the governor's staffers, but, you know, we're going to allow him to maintain a brother and we'll keep it at a distance from our coverage. And Cuomo on the air talked about a wall existing. And still, you got to wonder whether that would happen if he were an ordinary reporter and not getting important ratings and important revenue for the network in primetime. It seems as though, you know, it would be a good exhibit for those who say there are different rules for people at different places in the hierarchy. In this case, a guy at the very top gets off with no sanction at all.
Well, then there's Rick Santorum, who said this to a conservative group, the Young America's Foundation, back in April, about the founding of this country.
We came here and created a blank slate. We birthed a nation from nothing. I mean, there's nothing here. I mean, yes, we have Native Americans, but candidly, that there isn't much Native American culture in American culture.
And he went on Chris Cuomo's program and tried to defend himself. I'm going to just skip to a question to you in the time that we have. You know, he said, I was taken out of context. We treated Native Americans horrifically. And then CNN fires Santorum over the weekend. What do you make of that?
Well, let's not forget, they didn't fire him instantly. They fired him after basically 3 weeks of letting this lag around. Santorum may feel he was taken out of context, and certainly he may not have meant to slight the horrible treatment, the vicious treatment that American settlers meted out to Native Americans. But at the same time, he essentially wiped the slate clean. He did what Native American tribal leaders and also Native American journalists said, which was essentially erase their culture from the American experience, American history. This is not the first time Santorum has been pointed to or called out for deeply problematic remarks about folks. And it was one too many for CNN to sit with, apparently.
But just briefly, did CNN maybe lose something? He, Santorum, was one of the only conservative voices left on that network. And obviously people are saying it's inconsistent. Just have a few seconds here.
You know, I think that it's something that conservatives could point to, particularly pro-Trump conservatives could point to and say it seems disparate treatment. Santorum was one of those who wasn't necessarily a huge Trumper, but was anti-Trump critics. I think it's also part of the problem when you have people on who don't take for granted necessarily the search for journalistic truth and the sense of fairness. His brand of conservatism doesn't fit neatly with CNN.
We're going to leave it at that. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks.
You bet.
Well, what a year to be a teenager. From the pandemic to virtual school, some teens are now turning to art and music to express what they've been going through. In Nashville, some teens have put together a new record called Sing Through the Quarantine with the help of a mentorship songwriting program, Girls Write Nashville. Paige Flager of WPLN has more.
Are you human? Like being black in this world? Means I'm nothing.
In her song 2020 Vision, 15-year-old Tiana Williams set out to try and process how it felt to be a black teenager this past year.
Throughout 2020, whenever I will open up my TikTok, that's all you will hear is no justice, no peace. Because of the shootings, the killings, like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and it's saddening because that's my race, and it's kind of hard for me personally, because I lost a family member, friend, to gun violence 2 years ago now.
Williams says she was really struggling with her mental health, but the group Girls Write Nashville helped her channel those emotions into her song.
No pain, no justice, no justice, no pain.
The 10-song album really runs the gamut of teenage emotions. There's a bedroom pop tune comparing love to a contagious virus.
Your love is like a virus, you can't run from it. There's no cure for my toxic love.
And there's even a gritty screamo song about the pandemic.
You know, I know this is going to sound crazy, but yes, screaming my heart out about the pandemic did make me feel better.
Lee Mian is the 15-year-old mastermind behind the madness of the song called Pandemic.
But at the time, I feel like it was so cathartic. I don't know, all my songs are like vents. And so I think it's very fitting for the song. The song's not complex, it's just emotive.
For the last 5 years, Girls Right has strived to create a safe space where teens can share their experiences and make music together. Musician Ellen Angelico helps the young songwriter's vision come to fruition.
I'm like a kid conduit.
But this year was nothing typical. Angelico says creating music without being in the same room made it harder to forge that bond.
We were much more disconnected necessarily from the kids and from their ideas.
But those new challenges brought new opportunities too. This year, students recorded their songs at home using what was already at their fingertips, their cell phones. They even learned some song production skills with the app BandLab for Education before passing their recordings off to female studio musicians like Ryan Medora. Medora adapted her bass parts for a whole range of musical genres for the album, from Tiana Williams's gospel-infused song.
It's just very simple root notes. There's a little bit of movement between chords.
To something a bit more hardcore for Mian's screamo song. But she says her participation in the program is about more than just helping round out the song. It's about the example it sets for the students.
I started playing bass when I was like 14, 15 years old. Like, you're 14, 15 years old and you play bass. So like, it's very possible that like 10, 15, 20 years from now, you could be on this side of the session glass.
That sort of inspiration has always been the goal of Girls Right Nashville. But in a year as chaotic as 2020, showing the power of music was all the more important. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager. Love is like a virus, you can't run from it. There's no cure for your toxic love. I really don't know what to do. Your love spreads fast and the things you do, I can't handle it. My mind and my body can't handle it. I wanna be...
Oregon is the latest to call for people to show proof of vaccinations, kind of like a vaccine passport, in order to enter places like shops, restaurants, and churches without a mask. But some business groups are concerned these new guidelines put the burden on establishments. Let's check in now on how it's working with Amelia Templeton, health reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. She joins us now. Amelia, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Well, we should point out that regardless of vaccination status, everyone still has to wear masks on public transportation as well as in schools and healthcare settings, places like that. What's the response from the public on these new vaccine rules?
The response is really varied. I think, you know, in the Portland metro area, mask wearing is still very much the norm. And, you know, if you think back to the beginning of the pandemic, the Pacific Northwest was the first place in the country to have confirmed cases of COVID-19. We had mask mandates very early on that have been in place for the duration of the pandemic. And so for some people, you know, this is what has made them feel safe and comfortable. And it's going to take time, even for some vaccinated people here, I think, to feel comfortable removing their masks. I've actually been surprised, you know, the rules include anyone vaccinated or not no longer needs to mask in outdoor public settings. But you still do see some people wearing masks there. And then on the other hand, you know, like many places, masks are a political question. And so I think in other parts of the state that are less liberal than the Portland metro area, there's a lot more skepticism, a lot more pushback, and a sense that the governor is still moving far too slowly to return business and life to normal.
Well, let's break down some of what you said. Let's talk about enforcement of mask wearing. How have business groups responded to this idea of businesses having to essentially police people, requiring them to show proof that they've been vaxxed?
Well, you know, across the board, I think most businesses have said this is unworkable. And what the governor's guidance did, it gave businesses two options. They could either continue to require masks of everybody, or they could come up with some sort of system where they ask people to show their vaccination cards upon entry. And, you know, in theory, that could be a picture of it on your phone or the actual card or a photocopy. And, you know, the states also said if you have like a regular customer or employees who are there every day, they don't need to show the card every single time they enter. But even with those caveats, virtually every business that we've heard from has said this is just not a workable system. And
right, in fact, you have Oregon's, you have the Enchanted Forest Amusement Park, right, who just said that it would delay its reopening plans because they just can't police this.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a beloved sort of family-run institution in Oregon. They've been closed for a really long time. They were also devastated by wildfires a year ago. And so for them to say that they can't reopen because they fear the threats that they received and the conflict over, you know, making their employees try to enforce this kind of rule, it just shows you, you know, universally businesses are concerned about what do they do if somebody shows up and isn't just not willing to show their card or wear a mask, but, you know, wants to make a point about it and wants to make a sort of political point.
Well, about 64% of the population there has gotten one dose of the vaccine. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says the state's remaining restrictions will stay in place until about 70% of the eligible adult population gets at least one shot. What's the sentiment to the vaccination efforts there?
You know, I think Oregon really reflects a lot of trends that you're seeing in other parts of the country. So, you know, there's a significant percentage of the population here that is enthusiastic about getting vaccinated, but many of those people have now already gotten their shots. And so we're seeing the same sort of decline in new vaccination rates as the state tries to figure out how to reach out to people who, you know, maybe vaccination isn't convenient for them, or maybe they're anxious about shots in general. You know, maybe it's not an ideological opposition to vaccination, but they have a fear of needles. And then, of course, we have a group of people that is specifically against this vaccine and that has, you know, fears or has heard conspiracy theories, other things like that. So we have a variety of, I think, different groups of people who haven't gotten vaccinated yet. And the question is, will any of these incentives work, and who will they work for?
I have just under a minute with you, but a big test of this vaccine passport will be this Thursday's tip-off of the NBA Western Conference playoff between the Portland Trailblazers and Denver Nuggets. They will be allowed to actually be, folks will be able to be there without their masks on. What are some threads you're following as we get closer to Thursday?
Well, the irony is there is a section for people who can prove that they're vaccinated, but they aren't actually going to be allowed to take their masks off. It just lets people sit closer together. So, you know, again, Oregon's still taking a very cautious approach here. And, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see if that feels like a normal playoffs game yet. And if anyone... If there's any transmission of COVID-19.
Amelia Templeton is a health reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Amelia, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.